Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Heal Your Trauma Drama Show. My name is Madeline Standing, and today we're speaking with Dean Mays. Dean is an author from Adelaide, Australia, and he's a father, and he's had much success both on the web and in person with his sales. His publisher is Canadian, and if you want to learn more about him, you can go to deanfromaustralia.com as you listen to the show, deanfromaustralia.com. I want to go ahead and welcome Dean to the How to Ease the Hurt of Bullying show, and I really believe that Dean is the perfect person to speak to about this. Through the last three-year friendship that I've shared with Dean, I'm fortunate enough to cultivate and learn from Dean. I've learned that he has experienced many different things. I read his book, The Hamble Down Dream, and we have also had some conversations around bullying and what that looks like, how it affects us, and more so how we can be resilient during the fact of bullying, whether we're a child, a teenager, or a full-grown adult. So I want to go ahead and say hello to Dean. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Thank you. I did my headstands today, so I'm feeling lots of blood rushing to the brain. Very, very full day. How's your day?
It's very good. It's very hot down here in Adelaide today. It's just tipped, the mercury's tipped over to about 103 degrees Fahrenheit. So I'm sitting here in my office dressed down in shorts and a T-shirt. So.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds wonderful. I'm from the beach and living in Vancouver, Canada, all these last 8 years. I miss that. Is it humid there? I haven't been to Australia yet.
No, not so much in the south where I am in Adelaide. It's a very dry heat, so when it comes in really hot like it is here in the middle of summer, it's pretty intense. But the further north you go, you get into the much more tropical climates. As we're speaking, I'm hearing our news services down here are tracking a fairly large pair of cyclones in the northern part of Australia. So the weather has really switched it on for us today, all right across the country. So.
Well, thank you for joining us.
It's really something that
we've been looking forward to. And I know that there's been just some general questions for the show. And you and I have already looked at those, and there's just so much. The supply of what people perceive bullying to be is endless, whether it's verbal or physical, whether it's for children. I mean, there are mostly, when we Google what is bullying, just going, google.com, what is bullying, and it has lots of governmental sites. And it mostly pertains to kids. And I do want to look at a couple of things from that perspective, and then also just in general what it is that you think that everyone experiences as a whole when faced with different types of bullying. I was looking around online, and I found one thing. It was called nobullying.com. And I mean, I did find something actually encouraging. They said that actually fewer children are expressing the feelings of how, what people feel usually when they're being bullied. So whether it's low self-esteem or whatever it is, in this case, it's talking mostly about kids being more resilient and expressing fewer feelings of lower self-esteem after the fact of bullying, and actually expressing the innate desire to thrive and kind of conquer the effect of, and even the bullies themselves, and kind of to win the, nobullying.com says, you know, kind of to win the battle against bullying, and even that extends into the internet world of the cyberbullying. And it actually pointed out that, you know, 75% of these kids were on Facebook, and 54% of the 75 had actually experienced cyberbullying. I thought that was a startling number.
It's a huge figure, isn't it? So, yeah. I have two children, a daughter who's 5 and a son who's 8. And my partner and I are very cognizant of the need to, I don't want to say control their online activity. Neither of them are really that aware of the online world yet. And so, you know, they're probably a few years out from that experience, or those negative experiences, but it's something that we're very aware of going forward. And so equipping them with the skills to deal with bullying, both in a real world sense and a cyber sense. I mean, we're already doing that now, so it's mm-hmm. it's very much. Yeah, something that we're both aware of.
How old are your kids again, did you say?
My son is, he's 8, and my daughter Lucy's 5.
Okay, wow. So, for instance, I have a niece in Virginia. She is 7. She just turned 7, and she's already on her cell phone. I'm pretty sure she's on the computer, and I don't know how she's monitored or not monitored. I mean, what do you think is excessive, and what do you think is helpful to nurture, just to kind of almost postpone that experience of bullying that by the fact that shows that it's so rampant online?
Yeah, well,
I think
in the first instance, I think it's important to instill a sense of the online world is not the be all and end all of living. So in a sense, we're trying to not diminish the role of the online world, but just to try and, you know, it's not that important in terms of the way you interact with people. And I think that for our children, it's very important that they nurture real relationships in the real world and focus upon mm-hmm. those as the most important thing rather than the online world. I mean, neither of our children have Facebook accounts. And I mean, obviously, they're quite young. But going forward, I'm reluctant to allow them to have a Facebook account until, you know, basically they're old enough to leave home. And that might seem a little
right.
That might seem a little bit draconian, but I think that it's important that we protect them as much as possible from, you know, the negative aspects of social networking and cyberbullying.
Right. There's just too much leeway. There's too much room to stretch in any direction you want when you have access to, you know, a screen, a modem, and a mouse. You can go anywhere, and you could end up in rough terrain if you're not careful.
Sure.
Especially, well, anyway, I mean, so when you Google, have you Googled the definition of bullying?
I have Googled it in preparation for our talk. I sort of looked a bit wider into, you know, more government sources of definitions of bullying, I guess, that have been prepared by government, non-government organisations. So, but the definition that you put forward just before, I think, is is pretty much perfect.
Well, I mean, in, you know, it's, they say, like, the basic definition, and, you know, who writes the definitions for Google? We don't know. And I oftentimes find myself stretching outside of those definitions and wondering, thinking about things in a different context to what those definitions are that we read. It's always helpful to gauge, you know, the real literal, like, for instance, it says, you know, the use of superior strength or influence to intimidate someone, typically to force them to do what one wants. So I'm curious, and you know I'm going to ask you this question, what is what is your definition?
My definition is probably not that far removed from that definition, but I think the key word there is intimidation, and using the, you know, using strength to intimidate or influence. Bullying to me is an act of intimidation. So I think that's probably the best definition that I could give you. So,
right. You know, I recently was thinking about it because in preparation for sharing this conversation, and I think that oftentimes bullying can be, it's like a projection of your reality onto someone else, and acting as if your perception of reality is the only reality. For instance, here's a funny story. I have a home office, and I'm an incredibly outgoing person. It's challenging because, you know, I like to get dressed up to go to work. And when you work for yourself and you have a home-based online business, it's few and far between that you actually have, like, a real reason to, you know, get dressed up and do your makeup and your hair. You can kind of get away with, as lots of writers do, going to work in your pajamas.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, you know, whatever writer's conference I've gone to, whether it's been in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, I always hear someone get up to the podium and talk about how the luxury of even J.K. Rowling sending their kids off and their husband off or their wife off to work, and they get to sit in their pajamas in front of their computer. Well, I, as much as I love that, I also like to, you know, I'm outgoing, I always have been. So I like to go to different cafes that are local, you know, have some lunch and sit and be intense in front of my computer and, like, have my single focus on the screen or my pad and paper. And I can hear the buzz around me, yet, you know, it's that's the fun of being able to, you know, have that, all that different stimulation around you while saying I am dedicating to being focused right now. So anyway, long story short, I went to this great cafe and I was having the time of my life sitting in front of my computer, writing and reading and doing my emails and then turning all my internet stuff off and just focusing on creative writing. And, the owner of the cafe and I had built up a rapport. And she'd come over and say hello to me, you know, every time I'd go in. And I'd always, since she's so friendly, be polite and turn, you know, my kind of turn my laptop in a sort of face it the other direction and turn my body to, you know, talk to her. Anyway, lo and behold, it turns out that she actually was feeling sorry for me. She thought in her mind, if you're sitting alone and you're focused, and you go somewhere, and you sit alone. It was 2 hours. This is my luxury time. This is when, like, it's just a blessing, a gift from above that I get to sit down and just tune out the world and focus on the projects of my dreams, you know, and just for 2 hours of the day, my dog's not around, you know, there's no boyfriend, there's no nothing. And this is my bliss. And it just, like, it struck me that as she was leaving, one day, she came over, and at the top of her lungs, she goes, "Oh, my God, I don't want to leave you alone." And I started laughing, turned a little red in the face, and patted her on her arm really quickly and said, "Okay, it's okay." because here I am on cloud nine, having the time of my life, and here this person is projecting their reality. And she actually did it a couple more times, and I just thought, and everyone in the cafe literally stopped, looked at us like, "What?" And I just thought, okay, she's not trying to be offensive. She thinks she's being kind. But this is my 2 hours every day that I get to tune out. So at the end of the day, we have to change our own behavior. Like, my behavior was pick a new cafe, and don't take it personally.
Yeah.
Don't take it personally, as Don Miguel Ruiz says in his Four Agreements book. And, at the end of the day, we can't, I think that's the saving grace for any form of projection of one's reality, where it's really aggressive and it's like basically saying, this is your reality, and if it makes you feel bad, it doesn't matter, because my reality is, needs to be heard and injected into your moment, So it kind of bothered me, because here I am, again, it was like, for me, that was as good and clean as her intentions were, it was the fact that, she projected her sense of what my reality was, and in kind of an embarrassing way, So I think that bullying extends beyond the classroom. I think that especially in different corporate settings, I used to hear horror stories from my mother. And I totally want to open the floor up to you to share anything that might have come up for you while I was sharing that story with everyone.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess there's probably two instances where bullying was a significant event in my life. And I know you and I, Madeline, have spoken off air in preparation for this show that... I talked about bullying in my childhood as opposed to bullying in my adult life. When I was a kid, my younger brother was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. It's a form of lymphatic cancer. And at the time that he was diagnosed, this was the early 80s, we grew up in a really small town in country Victoria and here in Australia. And people's understanding of cancer was fairly limited at that time, certainly not in the way that it's understood now. And both my brother and I experienced bullying, in the sense that he experienced bullying in a way that when he began to have chemotherapy for the cancer, he lost all his hair, and he was 4 years old, 4 years old going on five, and so to turn up at our primary school, or elementary school as you would call it there, quite pasty and emaciated and bald, it was quite a confronting thing for a lot of our contemporaries, our kids to see, and a lot of kids repelled at that, and by extension their parents repelled at that as well, because was he contagious, could he infect any of us, my being his brother and being close quarters with him, could I infect people. So there was a lot of shunning and a lot of aggressive behavior, not only by children but by adults towards both myself and my brother, and I guess to a lesser extent my parents, but I mean that would be a you know a separate conversation that
Right. There's a lot of
quite
fear.
in-depth.
I mean, it's safe to say that a cause of that bullying that you experienced, Dean, is bottom line fear. It's a real safe way to say that those people. What else would you say that it is that caused those people to act in ways that were knowingly hurtful?
I think that that's a very good point, fear. And, you know, we're going back to, you know, the idea of intimidation and projecting one's own reality onto other people. And so for them, you know, for the people around us who, you know, projected their fear and their reality onto us, that was very much a hallmark of you know what I regard as bullying at the time. So,
how did you get through that as a kid?
It's interesting because back then, the kinds of support mechanisms that are available now didn't exist. So, my family. We tended to cope with it in isolation, and it was a fairly confronting experience that I think took us many years to really come to grips with, purely because we really didn't understand what was happening at the time. So the coping with it, the managing of it. Probably took, you know, 10 to 15 years, you know. A lot of growing up and a lot of, I guess, gaining perspective from, you know, later on. But at the time, it was an extremely isolating experience.
What would you, and I believe a lot of us can relate to that sense of isolation when there's isolation can be a byproduct of ignorance. When there's ignorance around a topic, it's almost like the ALS nowadays. It's a real in the closet topic, and only because of the ice bucket challenge is it more well known. And yet, I think there's been a lot of fear and small-mindedness around how to support someone, even if they're, you know, one of your closest friends or neighbors who has someone in their family who's struggling with that or themselves even. So would you say that you'd kind of relate, I guess there's two parts to that, so would you relate what your brother had with something like that? The ignorance and the sense of.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think ignorance was a major factor. I think in the misunderstanding that led to the bullying that we experienced individually and together. So.
Right, and you know, ignorance can be really connected to judgment, of jumping to a way of responding to something just because we don't understand it. And I wonder, as a successful writer now and someone who has, you know, you have a couple of careers that you're very proficient at, what if you could talk to that little boy who was you and who was going through what you did, what would you, as an adult, what would you say to that little boy who was, in a sense, suffering in isolation versus perhaps finding some way to approach it, whether approaching the actual bully or bullies, or just finding a way to see it so that the moments of the day, whether they're, you know, you're not around them or you are around the cause of the bullying, can be a little lighter and more hopeful.
Yeah, sure. That's a really, really good question, and it goes to something that that I've been doing, you know, recently. I see a psychologist, and probably at the beginning of last year, we started a process called schema therapy, and it was actually it was a re-examination of certain critical events that had occurred in my life that have, I guess, shaped the way that I respond to certain situations. And what schema therapy does is that it enables you to revisit certain critical events from the past and examine them and then insert new information into the experience that allows you to see them differently. And so one of the exercises that we did was that we actually journeyed back to a number of particular incidences where I could actually step out and talk to the little boy that was me, and we reshape the experience based upon, you know, what I know now. And that was a very powerful tool.
Kind of like narrative therapy.
Yeah, very much so. It was a very powerful tool that enabled me not only to reinterpret the experience, but kind of come to peace with it a little bit.
Powerful.
So, yeah.
Powerful.
Yeah. So, schema therapy is a very powerful tool, which certainly helped me to overcome those experiences, I guess you could say.
Right. And that's why, you know, Dean, when I learned that you had experienced bullying, I was surprised because I couldn't really, from the outside in, how we all view each other, really, you know, we can observe how one another speaks. And when it's like you and I, we know each other a lot through social media and emails. So we're almost left to our own device of imagination. And yet, you know, you've accomplished and continue to accomplish so much with your narrative success, with your writing, creative successes, and how you get behind your work. And, you know, you have this great publisher behind your work, and you have so many fans who support you.
Yeah.
I was so surprised.
That ability to reflect, I think, informs my journey as a writer, because I've often said in the past that I'm kind of a late bloomer when it comes to my writing career, and I'd said that up until I published my first novel, I wasn't really in the right headspace to actually complete a work of fiction, or, you know, a work of any literary work, really. But there was a certain point at which I became more reflective about my life and about the things that had happened in it. And writing has become a way for me to reflect on a lot of things, you know, that are happening in my life now, that have happened in the past. And certainly with my first novel, The Hambledown Dream, that was very much an exploration of myself through a pair of characters that that occupy very different spaces. And both of those characters were informed a lot by, you know, the experiences that I'd been through whilst young and, you know, going forward into, you know, early adulthood. So I don't think I could have written my novels before the period of time that I did, because I just don't think that I was there in a reflective headspace. If that makes any sense.
It does. It does. And, also what I hear is that reflecting is a great tool. Being open to reflecting through creative writing and or with a professional who enjoys exploration of the human psyche and is willing to jump on board with you as you explore different situations, that's it sounds creative writing and reflecting in general, they're two tools of resiliency when faced with any challenge, including the bullying.
Sure.
I have a question. I have one last
Yep.
question, and that is, if you could get an apology from the people who have bullied people, including you, because there's no doubt that if they've bullied you, then they've likely bullied other people too in their lives. It's a bit of a habit. So, without losing the question there, if you could get an apology from those people who you've experienced bullying with and been on the tail end of it, how important would that apology be to you now?
To be honest, Madeline, I don't think of it as wanting an apology from them. In fact, I don't want an apology from them, because I think that the bullying that I experienced was more a failure of them than it was a failure of me. And so, by wanting an apology from them, it kind of signals to me that I haven't truly moved on from the experience. So,
Absolutely.
yeah, I think it's actually more a case of I'm at a point now where I can forgive them. Because it's almost like they may not have reached the point of being able to reflect. And so that's actually quite a sad thing. And so for me to sort of want an apology from somebody who I really don't think can reflect on what it was that they had done. Yeah, it's a hiding to nothing, I guess you could say. Does that make sense?
Sure does.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Dean Mays, author of The Handle Down Dream, Gifts of Paramang, and The Recipient. Dean is based in Adelaide, Australia. You can hook up with Dean online at deanfromaustralia.com. You can learn more about the movement of supporting resiliency after all forms of abuse at both vivastanding.com, vivastanding.com, and healyourtraumadrama.com. You've been listening to Dean Mays, Madeline Standing. Thank you so much for being here today, Dean.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.